Working Cows Podcast, episode 124.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And I'm really excited to dive into this episode today. But first, I wanted to encourage you to stick around after the episode. Got something I'd like to share with you. Kind of a big week here at the Working Cows Podcast, coming up on realizing a goal that I kind of set for the podcast as I set out to do it. Kind of one of those things that was way off in the distance that I couldn't have imagined happening. And we're going to talk about that after this episode. We're going to talk today about grazing irrigated cover crops, irrigated circles, pivot irrigation, and some of the things that this individual, Chuck Cosgrove, was able to accomplish with that in terms of profit, in terms of improvement of land with cattle, in terms of seeing really all of these paradigms that we've been talking about for the past 2.5 years come together. So, Chuck, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Glad to be here, Clay.
I would like to hear a little bit about how you got started grazing under a pivot and kind of what brought you to that point and how you had continued to develop that practice throughout your time.
Sure. Like most of us, I'd rather be in a saddle. I'd love to be an owner of a massive ranch and spend all my days working cattle from a horse. But having said that, with my background in helping some ranchers do some financial assessments way back in the day, I realized that probably the most efficient way to raise cattle would be under irrigation. And as so many things are, that just by fluke, I was driving into one of my clients' places one day, and I looked and I saw a bunch of cattle just kind of roaming free under a pivot, and drove right up to the house and told Neil, "Hey, you got cattle on a pivot?" And he said, "Uh-huh." And I went, but Neil, they're on a pivot. And he said, "Uh-huh." And that was the start of a paradigm shift for me. He and that family had a big outfit, and they kind of turned them loose on there, a little different than what we're doing. But it was that concept that made me think there's something here. So over the years, I read a lot of Stock and Grass Farmer and read as many other things as I could find, and concluded that running cattle under a pivot in a management intensive system was probably the best thing I could do to make some money. So we got down here to central Utah a few years ago and happened to find a place that had some pivots for lease. And just about that time, Bert Teichert, who's a friend of mine, was kind enough to drag me and three other guys up to North and South Dakota and Eastern Montana for a week or so. And we toured around and saw a bunch of places, including Gabe Brown's and Ray Bannister's and some other folks who were kind enough to visit with us. And that turned my head around to the second paradigm shift. And that was using cover crops. I felt like that was a really big deal. I also then had attended the Jim Gerrish workshop and really liked what Jim said and had a chance to tour a place that was set up using Jim's system. And I liked that and thought, boy, I'd love to be able to do that. But the owner of the place I was leasing, I didn't want to put in the water lines, and I wasn't sure about the place in general. So I looked around for another option. And, you know, you see all over the place, pivot grazing talks about the flexible fencing that, you know, you can roll over and gates for the pivots, for the wheels and all that kind of stuff. And I understood that, but it troubled me because any of that kind of stuff meant that my ability to farm it was going to be a little bit limited. And given the situation here in central Utah, in the West Desert is what they call it, with basically zero organic matter, I knew that I needed to use the cover crops to improve the soils. So I looked really hard for alternative ways to build this in, including, you know, dragging water lines behind the fence, behind the pivot, which just made a big, soggy, pugged up mess. And I just couldn't think of anything until one day I found the Gallagher tumble wheels. And Clay, that whole system is really, it's really three or four paradigm shifts, you know, all aggregated together. And it was that drove us into doing it this way.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. And I opened this up to some questions from my private Facebook group and got quite a big response and lots of interest in different things like that. So really looking forward to diving into this with you. And I guess the first question on the list, and I think the first one that we should probably deal with, is what is the fencing strategy that you're using for the pivots and the intensive grazing? How was that laid out in your operation?
Well, I hope I can explain it well. I'm sure you'll put a link to our website. I should emphasize we're not selling any of the equipment or anything like that, Clay. This is not a money-making venture, this conversation. But here's what we figured out. If I take and I stretch a hot wire, braided poly wire, from one of the pivot towers, one of the legs of the pivot tower, right out to the edge of the circle, then I've got a lot of distance there. If I put one of those ahead of the cattle and one of them behind the cattle, that gives me a nice little working area. The concept that I wanted to really emphasize for us was twofold. First, making sure that we had fresh forage essentially constantly, with an emphasis on the afternoons when we had the best bricks. But then the second part of that was keeping the cattle off of the forage once they'd grazed it. So we wanted what amounted to a flexible pie. And the problem with all that was that huge span. And I should get a commission from Gallagher on this, but if folks look up tumble wheels on the Gallagher website, and I don't know of anybody else who does it, we put, I think it was 8 tumble wheels between the external edge of the pivot and the pivot tower itself. And that was really all we needed. Now, at the far edge, we built this little cart that had an upright that was about the same height as the center of the pivot wheel, of the tumble wheels. And that meant that we could take our reel, just a regular old hot wire reel, and we could lift it when we were ready to move. I could lift it off that cart. It just had a little hook there. And I could walk that wheel forward. Walk that fence line forward. So I could move 5 times a day, which is what we typically did. And it took me about 10 minutes. That was it. That meant that basically constantly through the day, those cattle were in fresh forage and able to basically keep as full as they wanted, and just had it was a really relaxing life form. I think we've even got a video on our website of, you know, a quick little snippet of a move. So it took very little time. As we moved that forward, we would leave the back fence still in the same place, which gave us a kind of a loafing area. And that was very comfortable for the cattle and kept them really fresh. And the other part of that is, as we moved, they weren't pushing to go down below basically the top layer of the forage. So we consumed a lot less forage than I thought we would. And that was, you know, big part of the process.
And we will link to the website at workingcows.net/124, workingcows.net/124.
24 is going to be the link for the show notes page for today. And when I went through the High Plains Ranch practicum, they said that when they talked about irrigated grazing, they were going to stand on a chair so that everybody in the room knew that they were talking about something totally different than just dry land grazing or grazing annuals or grazing native range. So kind of what were some of the differences in grazing this way? And you mentioned taking advantage of high Brix numbers in the forages themselves. What were some of the advantages? What were some of the challenges? How did you maximize the advantage and mitigate the challenge?
Good questions. Let me start off with the challenges first. The first challenge, I think this is probably accurate for all areas where you're grazing with using a hot wire as your, you know, your primary fence. That's getting the cattle, you know, accustomed to that. The first year we had cattle come in and they just ran through all the fences. I mean, it didn't matter how hot they were. So the next year we, you know, once we got through that big mess, we gave them a bit of an acclimatization, both in the corral, doing things that, well, Steve Kenyon is where I got that idea, you know, where you put the fence offset inside and then you hang a few pop cans from there and zap a few noses, and that got them straightened out pretty quickly. But then we moved them to an area that was not concentrated and gave them a few days to get accustomed to a hot wire where there was no pressure. Then we were able to move them on there, onto the pivots. So that was the first one, but was fairly easily managed. The one I felt, we had three pivots and they were kind of in a north-south line. So we set it up so that we would seed sequentially. We didn't want everything to, you know, to mature at the same time. So we would go up the west side and then down and around and make a loop down to the east side, and then back and around. So it gave us, depending on the number of cattle and the temperature, you know, all those factors, it gave us between 24 and 40 days of rest after a grazing event. The thing about that I found most challenging was getting my mind wrapped around the water. I needed to make sure that I had water on the forage prior to the cattle, recent enough that I wasn't getting any drying or having any kind of stress on the forage, but far enough out so that I wasn't pugging that pasture. That took a little bit of getting my head around to do that. It was a lot easier once we had a really nice thick canopy. Even here where it gets to, you know, June to July, you're looking at 100 degrees. I found that I had a lot more elasticity or flexibility in that. If I kept the ground good and well watered, then I didn't have to worry about it as much. But I'd say that was a, you know, big challenge for us. So really, those were the two that I found the most difficult. One that I worried about was moving the cattle from, you know, pivot to pivot and around, but honestly, it just really wasn't a big deal. They just kind of followed that fence. They became so tame that it was even more disappointing. I spent even less time in the saddle because there was almost no reason to get in the saddle, and I was too busy doing other things and keeping the pivots running and whatnot. So those were probably our biggest challenges. That would be applicable to basically, you know, any kind of an outfit that did that. One that I'm sure will come up would be keeping the cattle with fresh water. But that turned out to be really an easy thing the second year. The first year was a real challenge. The second year was a lot easier once I kind of figured my system out. And we really came right off the pivot itself. We put a valve in that would allow us to take water off that, even if we weren't using that pivot to irrigate. So we had, you know, 40 pounds of fresh water, and essentially we had what amounted to a Christmas tree. We'd come off that the pivot tower with one, you know, flexible blue pipe, just collapsible, blue pipe. Mm. And then we would split that off so that we had three 300 gallon troughs. And, you know, that was easy because as we rolled that fence forward and the last of the three troughs was then outside of the pie, that movable pie, we just drained it and dragged it to the front, and it became the first trough. And so they just leapfrogged each other, you know, day by day. So the great part of this, and one of the reasons that people have not done that is because of the damage that we've all felt would happen right there, you know, close to the pivot tower.
Sure.
We didn't find that. And the reason is because we moved fairly quickly. And so there was very little damage. And what little was there, it just came back fairly quickly. So that wasn't a problem for us at all. The other challenge would be related to the forage quality. You're talking the freshest possible forage that you can get. And I should say, with respect, great respect for Gabe and everybody else, and we can address this maybe later in detail, we did not allow most of our forage to get fully mature, which I recognize reduces the potential impact of having a cover crop cocktail. We made some decisions to do that. I'll get into that a little more in detail, but because we had stuff that was, you know, kind of 3 to 4 feet tall, we had such great leaf coverage and you know, our ADF was probably 20% at the most. So these cattle would get just a little loose. In other words, you don't want to stand anywhere close to their back end because you might get wet. So what we would do is we would put a bale of straw or some, you know, some hay in there, and they would just pick at that as, you know, as they need. Just leave it free choice out near the edge of the circle, so that cattle could come and consume that to kind of keep things a little more balanced. And that seemed to make a difference. We didn't find a lot of sore stomachs, very little acidosis, near as I could tell, but I'm sure there was some, and we mitigated that a little with that. Now, on the other hand, the benefits, Clay, were amazing. Couple of things that really surprised us. I'm an old feed guy, and so I did some projections of gains and did some estimates of, you know, forage quality and my NEM and NEG and all that kind of stuff. And I was just completely wrong. It was so much better than I thought. I mean, we just had cattle coming in and gaining, you know, a good 3 pounds a day. We actually never were below 3 pounds a day, and we did have one set of cattle that weren't, I mean, they were nice cattle. I don't want to make it sound like they weren't, but they weren't exceptionally green or, you know, anything like that. But they did a little over 4 pounds a day. And that was that, you know, we had a certified scale. So, you know, we're not making any of this stuff up. But in fact, I have to say we were totally surprised by it. So that was a real bonus. You had lush pastures. Depending on the year, we had between 11 and 15 or 16 different plant types in there. And it was terrific. I mean, we just, once we got them started, again, we had the heat to be concerned with and a bit of wind. But we had really, really nice forage. And that was a huge bonus. The gains were terrific. Second thing that really surprised us, again, came back to my lack of experience, and that was I had built in about a 15% trample factor, and that was a waste. I can't actually explain this fully for you. I don't want to make it sound like I got all the answers, but I think because we took so little and moved on and then had that back fence, we would find that a chunk of forage that we'd eaten a couple of days before would almost invariably bounce right up. And you could tell it was lower, you know, but we would leave between 14 and even 20 inches of forage behind us, depending on the time of year. And of course the speed with which we were moving. And, we found that the trampling was pretty nominal, which you can say is good and bad. For us, it was really good because the plants jumped right back up and went back to work. And that was terrific. So that was a huge benefit for us. Then finally, because of that, we were able to modify our grazing pattern as we got closer to the fall. And that would allow us to leave, say, a half a pivot, and we would allow that to really fully mature. And that's where we felt like we were starting to get a little bit of soil organic matter built up. It wasn't like the rest of it was bad because, you know, there was relatively low stress on the plants, both in terms of the number of bites and the time that they were trampled, and never a stress in terms of the water. So we know that, like, we could see visually between spring and fall that there was a nice root system building up.
Sure. Yeah. That sounds really good. I want to transition by asking you about your soil type on this project, because I've talked to people who have done some grazing under pivots and have gotten reports back that the parasite load is incredibly high in the fecal samples that they have sent in. And those specific experiments were done in some pretty heavy soils. Heavy clay soils, and so I didn't know if you guys were in a different type of soil or if you guys experienced any of that or had any issues with that.
Well, that would have been one of the benefits for us. We planted some plants like mustard. You know, we had some Florida broadleaf mustard that we planted in there, and I want to make sure everybody understands it does take the cattle a little bit to get a taste for that, but we didn't find those parasite loads. In fact, it was exactly the opposite. We had some organic cattle come in one year, and I don't want to make it sound like the producer's a bad producer. The cattle were fabulous cattle, but because they were organic, they were covered in flies. And I think partly because of the plants, but just as much because we moved so quickly. 2 weeks later, they looked like they were, you know, just regular cattle that might even have had a fly tag in their ear. But getting back more closely to the original question of soil types, we were, this whole area that we're in out here is the ancient river and lake bed of Bonneva Lake in Utah. So depending on where you are, and I mean, it can vary widely. We had parts of one of our pivots that were just pure sand. I mean, just nothing but sand. And 10 feet from there, down slightly toward the center of the pivots, it was pretty heavy clay. So we had a wide range of soils, and some plants work better in some parts of it and some in others. But we didn't find a great deal of difficulty with any of that stuff. We did find that in this area, it's pretty saline. We had high pHs, and so we had to be very careful about which plants we were using. You know, for example, we tried hairy vetch, and we tried some Balanza clover, and neither one of those grew very well for us at all. So we had to kind of modify that. But even with our soils and the variations there, we were pretty good, pretty comfortable with them.
Well, we had a bunch of questions about just that, about the mixes of annuals and perennials, warm and cool season, species mix, grass versus legumes, some of those things. So could you talk about a little bit about that? What did you found that worked well? What did you find that worked well? And what were some of the things? You've already mentioned a couple of things that you didn't continue to use, but could you talk a little bit about your species and your mix of annuals versus perennials?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I should emphasize a couple of things. I don't want to come across as an expert on cover cropping. Gabe Brown and others were really helpful to us. We did work some with a company out in Nebraska that was helpful. We did, again, and we're a little unique because our pHs were, on our home place, we're up 8.2, 8.3. Out there at the lease place, we were about 8. And we found that even though that seems like a slight difference, there were plants that we could grow out there that could not grow on our home place. So because of some of that stuff, we tried to give ourselves a little bit of a base of some annuals. And we did a little barley. We did some triticale, some fall wheat. And then we also added into that. So really, Clay, we had two seedings per year. We'd have something that might start in the fall or early in the spring. And by that here, I mean like late February, early March. And that's going to be our cool season. So we would do that kind of stuff. We would try to put some legumes in there too. You know, we'd use some winter peas. We did every year. We included some fall rye because that worked pretty well for us. We did try some sun hemp. We had some cowpeas. Let's see. I think we put some plantains in there, and it varied every year. We tried some milk, Sicer milk vetch, but the peas. We did some. That actually is probably most of it now. Having said that, our plan was to transition and get some more perennial stuff in there. So we put some sandfoin in there. We put some trefoil in and started moving to that as we could afford to, you know, to do so. Then our mixes changed, you know, again, spring, fall. I've mentioned some of the cereals for our summer, like warm season kind of stuff, which was planted usually after one or more grazings in May, when we had it not eaten down deeply because we just didn't do that, but when we had it eaten down a little bit, we go in and no-till in some pearl millet. We really liked the BMR corn. Cattle liked that and did well. We actually put a little crabgrass in there just as a test, and it didn't really do very well for us. And then we also used some foxtail millet in there, and then some sorghum sedan, and so that was our summer kind of mix. And there were let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8. There were 11 plants in that mix. The plantains didn't do super well for us, but you know, lots of the others did. And I really want to emphasize that some of these plants that we put in didn't grow for us. We wouldn't put heavy, you know, applications of them in there if we were testing them. Just gives us something to kind of look at and see what happens and what might work for us. And then we would call around and talk to people, whether they be growers or distributors or folks that are much more comfortable with cover crops than us. We relied heavily on their kind of input and feedback. Couple of things that worked for us really well, a couple of surprises. We did the Impact Forage collards and some turnips. We tried app and turnips and purple tops. And those things were really nice for us. The collards were surprising. They, again, we didn't eat them to death, but they came back and they stayed green, well, really through the whole winter, two years in a row. And then the other surprise for us was how well and how quasi-perennial some of our cereals were. We had barley that was there. We planted it in year one, and it was still there in year three. And I think the main reason for that is it never was allowed to mature on. It happened where it continued. It was in a quarter of the pit of one of the pivots that we never did allow to get mature. So it just kept coming just really, really well. Couple of things that we really wanted to try were the Lana woolly pod vetch and a couple of medics and some other species of soybeans, or some other varieties rather of soybeans that we didn't get to try.
I've got a couple of questions kind of along the same lines of, what are the best forage blends to justify the cost of irrigation? Were there some that perform better economically for you, not just from a pound of gain per pound of seed, so to speak, or something like that, but were there some that perform better economically for you?
Yeah, love the millets. I was very surprised. I can't tell you whether it was the Apache Pearl Millet or the White Wonder Foxtail Millet that did the best. Both of them seemed to do very well for us. The cattle gained very, very well. They sprang back just amazingly quickly. And then finally, they stayed. Now, the first year we did this, it was a pretty open winter. You know, it wasn't warm, but it wasn't really cold. We didn't have a killing frost until sometime in December, I think about the 10th of December. But those stinking things, those millets, just they grew right up until that killing frost and stayed green even after. They didn't wilt down. And that really, really surprised me. The millet was terrific. Now, it may have been that it was, you know, with several other legumes that provided some good nitrogen and all that stuff, but it was a terrific base for us in that warm season. And then it just kept growing and worked right through into the fall. So I love the millets, love the corn, really love the brassicas because they stayed green really through the whole winter. Again, we have pretty mild winters here, so that was a bonus, but they were terrific.
And what was your cost per pound of gain, if you got any numbers on that, and the stocking rates that you were working with in this? And I guess we've kind of left out completely the class of cattle. I thought about it earlier, but I didn't ask it, the class of cattle that you were grazing as well, so.
Well, we had several different classes of cattle through this whole experience. We had everything from, we wintered a lot of cows, so we would try and leave as much, you know, on the stump as we could, and then bring some cows in through the winter and give them more of the run of the place, so to speak, and just keep it pretty low intensity. And but we also had some heifers come in, some bred heifers came in the fall one year, and they'd been on range. They were very healthy, really nice shape, nice heifers, not green. They were in great shape, and they gained a little over 3 pounds a day. And then we had mostly, say, a 6-weight animal come in, and depending on the cattle, the gains were, you know, minimum about 2.5 pounds initially. And then as soon as they got acclimatized, they were well up to 3 pounds a day and then, or more. And I guess we had some really lightweight cattle come in one year. That was our first year. And they did fine. But that first year, we were just getting our system sorted out. And once we got that sorted out, then everything really started moving ahead. But that was us. In terms of our stocking rate, we had about 550 acres under pivot, and we ran about 600 head at any given time, but we could do more. And to say an exact stocking rate is pretty tough. I can tell you this, that when I was looking at my projections, and this part was actually fairly accurate, we figured about 22 acres per day on those cattle, but gosh, we got, I don't know if you'd call it loosey goosey. It really became clear that it was more of an art form than a science. Mm. Because the fences would move, like we'd roll that forward fence based entirely on what we saw on the ground with the cattle, whether they were content. You know, were we exposing too much, you know, to them, too little? We wanted to make sure there was some trampling. Like, it wasn't like we lined this up so they had 3 feet ahead of them And once they ate that, we exposed another 3 feet and so forth. But we did want to make sure that we had that really hard to achieve balance between enough ahead of them and not too much ahead of them, so that we were, I'm sorry that it's not as scientific as I would like, but it was really tough to tell because we just started moving. Instead of saying, okay, here's our exact measurement, we started listening to the cattle and watching the forage. And that really made the difference for us. I can tell you this, if once we were established, we could have moved up by another 200 head and had lots of forage ahead of us. Mm-hmm. But had we done that, we would have consumed more of that and had less of it for the winter, which really meant to us that we wouldn't have as much opportunity to give enough rest to a good chunk of that 550 acres, so it could grow up and become mature. That would therefore limit our ability to improve the soil. And so that's one of the reasons we did that. And then once the plants were dormant, then we could bring the cows in and let them do some grazing for us. But that way we could maximize that root development.
Yeah, I think I've heard Joel Salatin call that, what you're talking about, the difference between the science and the art form. I've heard him call that the grazer's eye, and that you get a feel for when those cattle are ready to be moved and when that land is ready for them to be moved off. And that's kind of, it becomes more of a feel thing than it is this many cows for this many minutes for, you know, on this amount of land. And it's not formulaic quite like we'd like it to be sometimes.
Well, I like numbers. And it was really hard for me to start doing that. It was like, oh, do I don't have it? And then finally, you know, after probably a month, you know, where I was going, you know, you're going a little too slow and a little too fast. And it was then that I think I started, you know, not like Joel, but I started to develop a little bit of a feel for that.
I got another one here, a couple of them that are kind of similar. Is he pumping from deep wells? And then the second part of that question is, how favorably does the math add up to other uses under pivot? And the other question that's similar says, how does it fit in a crop rotation? So I guess I'd like to know, were these pivots being used for anything else at different times of the year? And how are those all feeding each other?
Oh, man, more good questions. I would say, well, let's put it this way. If you figured, I calculate today that my seeding costs are going to be in and around that $33 an acre. Okay, now that's direct for seed. And then if you consider, and I just calculate this based on lease rates, if you figure that you've got a seeding cost of about 20 bucks an acre for, you know, tractor and whatnot, there you go. You've got about 50 bucks per acre. But if I've got, let's say, 600 head and I'm putting 3 pounds a day on those cattle, then I'm generating far more than my costs. So let's say I've got 600 head. I'm doing these calculations and I've got 150 days equals that. Times that, you know, I'm getting 270,000. So Clay, that's, if you look at feeder cattle prices, and let's just say it's a buck, just to be even and easy, you know, over the course of a 5 month grazing period with 600 head, you're generating something like $270,000 worth of revenue. And so if I've got my 500 acres, I've got this more precise, but this will work for us. Let's go 50 bucks an acre. You know, you're looking at times that, and that's $25,000 times two, because I was seeding twice a year. So you got $50,000 of direct costs without anything for fertilizer. So folks can calculate that in for their area. And then I assumed that I was going to have about $100 per acre for whether it's pumping costs. Let's just call it that. So you've got that times that. There you go. There's another, you know, I spent about $65,000 on power and then some miscellaneous costs and all that stuff. This is profitable. There's no question that this is profitable. You can make really good money at this. I'm not a farmer. I'm a grazier. So I don't really worry about it in terms of a crop rotation. My crop rotation would be simply transitioning into a more diverse permanent pasture over the course of you know, several years using this system. But honestly, even if I have to seed twice a year, I'm still doing fine.
Sounds real good. How much forage production per acre were you expecting during this project?
I budgeted for about 5.5 to 6 pounds, 6 tons to the acre, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I got more than that.
I was going to say, was that accurate or did you exceed that?
We exceeded that.
Sure.
Yeah, we would have been closer to 7 ton.
Yep. What about your animal days per acre? I know we talked about stocking rates. Animal days per acre under the pivot.
If we got, had 600 head times 30 days, let's go 30 there and 5.5 months equals 600 times that. We got about 99,000 animal days per animal days
on the whole place
equals that divided by 550, 180 days per acre, plus the winter grazing for usually, well, we only had cows out there 2 winters, but we had cows out there for 1, 2, 3, 3.5 to 4 months, 200 head on the same country too. So, and we did, you know, we certainly took all the forage off through the winter, but we didn't have it nubbed down to the dirt. Lots of it came back in the spring.
Any supplementation in this project?
Nothing. We did for the cows in the winter. There was some on the last month. We had some higher quality forage that we brought in for them, but for the, you know, for the summer stuff that started May the 1st ish. And ended end of October. The only thing we had out there was salt. And to be really honest with you, they didn't eat any of it. I mean, you know, we'd have a block that would follow them around and 600 head might go through a block a week. But part of that is us. That's not something that most people should expect because we just weren't able to, like we even had some fairly, I don't know about sophisticated, but some custom mixes that we put together based on, you know, forage samples, because that's what I did for years. And formulating and feeding, sell and feed and feed consulting. And so I put together some mineral, not just salt, but some mineral mixes for the cattle based on, you know, the forage samples that we took. And they hardly ate any of that. I mean, it was very nominal, but we have that high salt in this area, and those mixes had very little salt, but they still didn't eat much.
And
to be honest with you, Clay, they hardly drank any water.
Sure.
You know, I mean, yep. You would think that we'd need a lot more than that. Part of it was that we had a lot of water flowing, you know, those troughs could never get empty. But even then, we hardly used any because the forage was so full of water.
Right. Yeah. So I think that was one of the things that you had emailed me about too, is that I'd mentioned the advantages of hard versus washy grass. And you said that you were kind of had something to say about that. And, you know, I've talked to people who talk about the fact that in Louisiana, they don't really grow grass, they grow tall water. And so I I don't know if you have anything you wanted to say about that here as we kind of move towards wrapping up. I do have one more question that I want to make sure we cover, but did you have something to say regarding those types of grass or the different, what we would say, qualities of grass, I guess?
Sure. I grew up and spent several years working in the feed consulting end of things in southern Alberta and Montana. And on the extreme west, my clients were right up against the mountains. Great grass. I mean, you'd walk out there and boy, middle of May, it was, you know, hip tall and man, it looked fabulous. And the cattle did okay. And I tested lots of grass all over that country on the west end. And then I had occasion to go up to Havre, Montana, a little north of Havre. And I'd not been out there much and drove out into a pasture and the grass was about 2 inches tall. At least it seemed like it to me. And it was thin. There, you know, I could see dirt. I mean, it looked tough. And I went, oh, there were no cattle around. And the guy sent me out and said, you know, said, take some samples out here. And so I did. And thought, man, this guy's probably got poor cattle. They're all going to die, da-da-da-da-da. And this was within a few days of having been, you know, on the west end of my area. And I got the two sets of samples back basically the same day. And that stuff on the west, which we all have all called washy grass, I mean, sure, there was some protein in it, but it was essentially tall green straw. Whereas that short grass prairie was in that 12 to 14% range. And it was, I mean, they call that hard grass for good reason. And those calves, I saw them and we compared weights. And I was amazed at how well they did and how fat the cows were. And I followed that rancher and ranches in that area for years. And it was very consistent. It might look tough out there, but those cows are going to do just fine. Thank you very much. But don't try and take some of those washy cows out there. Yeah. Sorry, don't take them the other way because, you know, it just didn't work.
Right.
You take those cows from that hard grass country and stick them on that soft grass and they kind of fell away.
So the last one that I have here from the group is, have you grazed alfalfa or have you learned any tricks for grazing on hot forages?
Yes. The first one would be to make sure that there's something, you know, with a little bit of roughage out there that's available, free choice form. That's pretty key from my experience. I haven't grazed a whole lot of alfalfa, but I have a good buddy who did. And Don had a rule, and that was his was not irrigated, but he was in a high rainfall area. And so, you know, it was virtually irrigated. So Don would go out before. He penned the cattle every night, and before he turned them out in the morning, he would go out into the field and he would pluck a couple of leaves. Now, this sounds goofy, but it works. And he would put them between his thumb and his forefinger and roll them. And he said, I would roll them just like I was rolling a cigarette paper. And he said, if they would roll, that is, if they weren't mushy, if they'd hold their shape and they'd roll into a little tight roll, then the cattle were fine to go on there. If, as I tried to roll them, it mushed, you know, it turned soft, he said, I would get bloat all day long. But if I'd wait a couple hours until the sun came up and kind of took that dew off that alfalfa, he said, they'd be fine. I just had to manage the cattle. Now, I want to give a big disclaimer. The guy had one eye and could barely see out of the other eye. So I don't know if Don was reliable, but he was a real smart guy and a real great cattleman. And he did it for years. And I know that he was very successful at it.
Well, any big takeaways or anything I left on the table, any big lessons that you learned during this project that you wanted to share?
I think the main thing is to adjust things to fit you. You know, I mean, again, we took intensive grazing, mob grazing, some would call it strip grazing, which is really what it was. And we combined pivot irrigation and cover cropping together into a kind of a dog's breakfast. And it just really worked for us. So it can be done. There's some basics to it. And there's a lot of stuff on our website. And if people want to call, I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Yep, and we will have a link to your website, which is fattedcalfcattle.com at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/124. If people want to check that out at workingcows.net/124, there will be a link to the website and anything else that Chuck wants me to put in the show notes page for today. So, Chuck, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Clay. Good talking to you.
Well, really appreciate Chuck taking time to share all that with us and doing some numbers on the fly there, and obviously a very intelligent guy, and really appreciate his his desire to be a service to those people who are listening to this podcast. And really excited about this weekend coming up on a trip to the Organic Alberta Conference and the Holistic Management Canada Conference, and opportunity there to talk about what I've learned over the past 100 plus interviews that I've done, and really just something that I thought maybe in a while, maybe longer than this, the podcast would open up opportunities like this, and opportunities to speak and opportunities to share about how the podcast has been changing me. And that is happening this weekend. So if you are planning to be there in Camrose, Alberta, Canada, at the Holistic Management Canada Conference or the Organic Alberta Conference, I'll be there flying in Thursday night, flying out Monday morning. So if you're going to be there, go ahead and send me a message on Facebook or look me up through the website or whatever, get in touch with me. And I'd love to have an opportunity to meet some of you guys as I'm at the conference or whatever that might look like. So looking forward to being there and looking forward to meeting some of you people that I have received communication from through the website at workingcows.net/contact or through the Facebook page or however else people have reached out to me. So looking forward to that and looking forward to next week's episode. Very interesting guest and a very amazing episode. Really enjoyed talking to Cooper Hibbard for episode 125 of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.